Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Ched Amud Aleph, 12 lines down. The Gemara here started with a question that Rav Shmuel Ba'aba Me'akronaya asked him, Rabbi Abba, whether the assessment of the individual's property is done bishalo, meaning his own property, what are the relative rankings of the properties that he has, or bishalo lam, shamin, do we do it after the market? Whatever the general marketplace views as being better quality, mid-quality, and lower quality properties, that will be the assessment of the level of property that he has. Rabbi Abba answered him that the Pasuk says, Meitav Sadehu, Meitav Karmo Yishaleim, which makes it sound like it's his property, and therefore it's Bishalohein Shamin. And then we brought a large Breita that seemed to indicate otherwise, because the Breita said, if he has Benonit and Ziborit. How does he possibly have Benonit and Ziborit without having Idit? The only way that could be possible is if you say that it is marked against the general market or an objective standard. If there's any relative standard, then how can he have Benonit and Ziborit? If his Benonit is the top property, then it becomes Idit. You can have Idit and Ziborit, but to have Benonit, you must have both Idit and Ziborit on a relative basis. So based on that, the Gemara wanted to conclude that the Breita was suggesting that Bishel Olam Shamin. The Gemara answered, that's not the case. The case here is where he did own Idit, and he sold it off. So at one point he had a relatively higher property than what he has now, but he already sold that property off. What's left behind is Benonit and Ziborit. So the determination of the Benonit and Ziborit is based on the property that he had earlier that ranked it in this manner. The Gemara says that makes sense because we have two Breitot. We have one Breitot that says that the Baal Chov collects out of Benonit, and we have one Breita that says the Baal Chov collects out of Ziborit. How can we reconcile those Breitot? The Gemara says, very simply, depends if he owned Idit beforehand or he did not own Idit beforehand. If he owned Idit beforehand, then what we're looking at here is Benonit and Ziborit. In that case, the Baal Chov and the Nizak will collect out of the Benonit, and the Isha will get out of the Ketubat Isha, will come out of the Ziborit. The other hand, if he never owned any Idit beforehand, and all he has is quote-unquote Benonit and Ziborit, and obviously here you still have to talk about some objective standard, otherwise why is it called Benonit and Ziborit, even though he has nothing better? Either you have to say that it's called Benonit because of its relationship to the marketplace, or because, as the Baal Yetzosu said, at one point he had some Idit here, even though it doesn't remain. But then his Benonit really turns into Idit. For him, that's the best property that he has. And so because of that, his Benonit becomes Idit, the Nizak can collect out of it, but Bachov is no longer allowed to collect from that, and the Bachov and the Ketubat Isha will collect out of the Ziborit. That's where we left off. So Vibaitema, so now the Gemara offers an alternative explanation to this steer in the Breitot, and says, Idi v'idi, shelo hayta lo Idit, machra. It's not a case where he had Idit beforehand and sold it off. V'lo kasho, that's not a problem. The difference is what the level of his Benonit is. In one case, his Benonit is equal to the marketplace Idit. In the other situation, his Benonit is equal to the marketplace of Benonit. So in this case, and Rashi already notes this, that the Gemara is assuming here that it's Bishel Olam Sheminan. Yes, we do assess it based on the objective market levels of property. And the question is, where does his property sit relative to the market? If his Benonit sits at the same level as a Benonit in the marketplace, then it'll be called Benonit. On the other hand, if his Benonit, which is middle class property, is at the same level as the high quality property in the market, then it's going to be called Idit. And that will contribute to the differences in the Breitot. In one case, his Benonit is deemed to be Idit because of its relationship to the marketplace. Versus the other case is Benonit, is really Benonit. So in that case, the Baal Chov will get to take from the Benonit. The case where it's deemed to be Idit, he will not have the right to take from it, he'll have to take from the Ziborit. Now, in doing this, there are, you can already see on the Mesorot HaShas, that there are alternate girsas here. Tosfot himself says, Hachi Garsinan, and usually when Tosfot says, Hachi Garsinan, it already means that he's seeing other girsot over here. The reason that you might opt for alternate girsot over here is that the Gemara in solving this steer in the Breitot then does not solve the original question, which was, we have Rabbi Abba saying Bishalohein Shamin, and then we bring a Breita that seems to indicate Bishel Olam. In this answer, the Gemara is saying, yeah, it is Bishel Olam Shaminan. Just a question of, what is the status of his property vis-a-vis the marketplace levels? But that means that they're saying the Braita is Bishul Olam, and then it is a stira to Rabbi Abba. So that's why there are alternate girsot here. You could see them. I'm not going to go through all the different girsot, but just be aware of the fact that this Yibayitema is a little strange because it does not carry on the previous solution of the Gemara. The previous solution of the Gemara says Bishalohim Shamin, that it is assessed based on the person's relative ranking of his own property. And then we say, okay, here's the solution between the Braitot, as well as the fact that it's not a stira to Rabbi Abba. This Ibaidema doesn't offer an alternative to that. This Ibaidema basically goes back and says, yeah, Bishalolam Shaminan. It's as if the different answer completely to the Braita. So it's not your standard Ibaidema, which is an alternate solution to the question of Rabbi Abba, as well as a stira to the Braitot. Here we're only taking care of one of the two things, which is the stira of the Braitot. We're not taking care of Rabbi Abba, and so it's slightly different Ibaidema, and that's why you end up with all of these alternate Girsaot, which are trying to prevent Braitot now being a stira to Rabbi Abba. V'Ibaidema, and now there is a third option, which is Idividi Gonshaita Benonit Shaloka Benonit Alma. In this case, his Benonit is equal to the Benonit in general. And this is what the Machloket is. Marsever B'Shalohein Shemin, and Marsever B'Shalolam Ein Shemin. And the Machloket is whether it's B'Shalolam or B'Shalohein Shemin. Again, here there was an alternate Girsa. Rashi brings it, which is Lishna Achrina Garsina Idividi Gonshaita Benonit Shaloki Idit Alma. When his Benonit is equal to the Idit Shalama. And then Rashi goes on to explain that it was a case where he sold it off, and therefore the question is depending on whether you do it based on his property or the market level of properties will determine whether his selling of the Edit has any impact over here. So that's why Rashi says it. Tosafot and Rashi both reject that second Girsa and say they prefer the Girsa that's found in the Gemara that we have, which is in a case where his property is equal to the market level Benonit. The only question is, Bishalohein Shemin, do we assess it based on his own properties? And therefore, since his property here is not his middle-level property, it's his best property, so therefore we're going to deem it Idit, even though it's equal to the marketplace of Benonit. Or, on the other hand, do we say that, Bishalohein Shemin, Shalohein Shemin, and therefore it's deemed to be Benonit, and that'll be the machloket between the two Braitot. But here again, at least there's one Braita that would support Rabbi Abba in saying B'Shalohein Shamin, and therefore that's a more palatable solution. The Gemara says then, Ravina Amar, Ravina brings a fourth possibility, which is B'De'ula Plige. They argue within the position of Ula. Da'amar Ula Dvar Torah Bachov B'Ziburit. That Ula says that Mina Torah, a Bachov, a creditor, is only entitled to take the lowest quality property. Shnemar, because it says when it comes to of taking of collateral to protect the creditor from losing out on the default of the debtor, b'chutz tamod, you stand outside, v'ish asher atan noshev bo, yotzi elecha et avot, the one who you are claiming against, the one that you are asking for payment, he will bring out the collateral to you. Now, as Tosafot knows over here, even though it's a shliach beitin, the beitin sends a sheriff in to make this collection, nevertheless, he stands outside and then the debtor brings in the object. He doesn't go into the debtor's house. Obviously, if he refuses, he might have to, but otherwise we allow the debtor to bring out whatever possession. Ma darko shel adam lotzi, lachutz, if you're given the choice to give collateral, what collateral are you going to give? Pachot shebekelim. You're definitely going to live the worst of the kelim as collateral over here. So therefore, the same thing applies with regards to land. The bal chov, the creditor's rights here, are simply to collect from the worst quality item, whether that is the metalklim, whether that is karka. He only has the right to take from the worst. Umatam amru bal chov bebenunit. So then why do they allow the creditor to take from middle-level property? Kadesh lo tino delet bifnei lavin. In order that we don't block the liquidity in the market or lock up the market. If creditors always think that when the guy defaults, he's only going to get the worst quality property, they're going to stop lending because they are at risk on defaults for getting the ziburit property. At least if they get benonit, they have a way or a better way to liquidate it and it's more readily available cash to them. And therefore, they will be more willing to lend. So now, first of all, just in terms of a problem with this structure, which is that the Gemara here, at least Ula is suggesting, that when he brings out the metallotilin, he brings out the worst of his metallotilin to reach the value that the debtor owes to the creditor. Well, didn't we just say in the previous amud, wasn't that the conclusion of the Gemara by Rav Papa and Rav Huna Brei de Rav Shua, that when it comes to metaltalim, everything is considered to be metav. So if everything is considered to be metav, why over here are we calling something that is taken out to be ziborit, in a sense, the worst quality? So some suggest that Eino Chanami, it's a machloket, that Ula does not subscribe to that position that everything is considered to be metav. And he thinks by metaltalim that there is differences in the ranking, and you could have something that's a lower quality of metaltalim. And he doesn't agree with this concept of metav. That's one way to deal with it. The other way to deal with it is saying that it's not an exact comparison. It's not saying that metaltalim are not metav. It's simply saying that, of course, within the spectrum of metaltalim, he's going to bring out the lowest quality that he has. And therefore, when you're extrapolating to karka, you should also only give ziborit, and nothing better than that. So it's not that it's a complete equation, it's simply an indication of the fact that in karka you should be paying ziborit and nothing better than that. The last possibility is that we're talking about two different things. It depends on the perspective of what you're looking at. In terms of liquid damages, we consider all metaltalim to be made of. But in terms of a mashkon, there are different things that you can give as a mashkon, and there's a spectrum of quality and value that you can give in a mashkon. And therefore, when you're looking at it from the mashkon, from a collateral standpoint, yes, there are gradations of items that are better quality or lower quality collateral. In the end, when it comes to liquidated damages, then it's clear here that we consider all of it to be metav because it can be liquidated and it can't be monetized. And so because of that, it will be deemed to be metav. That doesn't mean just because it's metav with regards to liquidity that there's still not a qualitative difference between the type of mashkon that you can get. So that's how we reconcile. Now the Gemara answers, Mar it le takanta dula, or Mar it le takanta dula. The two brightot will reconcile by saying one of them holds of ula, and one of them does not hold of ula. So Rashi interprets it, takes it at face value, and Rashi says that the tana of the brightot that says that the baal chov gets from the beinonit is the one who holds like Ula. He subscribes to Ula, who says that the Chachamim instituted that you get Benonit. The Braita that says you get Ziborit for the Baal Chov says he doesn't hold of Ula's Takana. And therefore you go back to the Doraita Din, and the Doraita Din is that you get Ziborit. So Rashi reads it at face value, very simply, that if you hold of Ula, then you get Benonit for a creditor. If you don't hold of Ula, you get Ziborit as a creditor because there is no Takana of Ula. So Shaul notes, this is very problematic, because Ula, as an Amora, is not the one who instituted this Takana. We have already in Mishnayot that a Baal Chov is entitled to Beinonit. We just quoted a Braita that's saying a Baal Chov is entitled to Beinonit. So where is Ula in this picture? Ula is clearly not the instituter of the Takana. For that reason, many Rishonim do not subscribe to Rashi's explanation. And you can actually see here in the Rabbeinu Chananel that the girsa that he had in the Gemara was not mar itle takata dula or mar leitle takata dula, but rather mar itle dula or mar leitle dula. He leaves out the word takanto. That's very significant in this case because that's not ascribing the takana to Ula, but rather saying that they subscribe to Ula. Well, if Ula didn't make the takana, then what did Ula do? So the answer is that Ula gave the explanation behind the reasoning of the takana. And therefore, the question is, do you subscribe to Ula's reasoning or do not subscribe to Ula's reasoning? So as Tosafot says over here, Mar leitle takanta dula, dafka hecha de leitle idit. The case where he has no idit, clearly doesn't have higher level property. The kasavar, the kevan de leitle ele beninit viziborit. And since now he only has beninit zibrit, then you have the problem that is mentioned in Nizakin and Gitin, which is mipnei ma baal chov ein dino bi idit. Why is the baal chov not allowed to collect from idit? There are two sides to this. The creditor doesn't get ziborit because otherwise you'll shut down the loan market, you'll take liquidity out of the market. On the other hand, we don't give him idit because we're afraid that people will then take advantage of these situations and plot or scheme to see the guy who's in desperate need of cash. They're going to lend them knowing that the collateral you get back is that idit property. So in essence, he'll buy it in a backhanded manner by lending the money. So in order to prevent that type of behavior, we put him at a benonit. So what Tosafot says is mar itle or mar leitle de takanta de ula is not about this issue of whether between benonit and ziborit, but the question is, do we worry about him taking the highest level property? One Tana here holds, does the reasoning that is, you're talking about the highest level property, then we worry about the creditor coming to take that property. Well, it depends on what you view this benonit and ziborit as. If you view this benonit and ziborit simply being, look, he has benonit property. For him, it's idit. Okay, it's for him, it's idit, but it's still benonit property. That's not going to cause a creditor to have malicious intent over here to take the property away because it's only benonit property. Even though for this guy, it's the best property, it's still only benonit on a marketplace level. It won't entice him to enter into a loan just to take the property. On the other hand, the other individual says this is the guy's best property. If it's his best property, that's idit, then it is subject to that reasoning in a nizakim. For Tosafot, the question is here, is do we worry about this predatory lending that would go on based on the fact that his benonit is the best quality of property? And that's the machloket in whether we subscribe to ula or not. There is a third view within the Rishonim, which basically says that there is a shita of Rabbi Shimon who believes that you collect, the Baal Chov collects from Idit min HaTorah, and that the Chachamim downgraded it to Beinonit. So that's the question here, whether you subscribe to Ula or don't subscribe to Ula. Subscribing to Ula means that you think that the min HaTorah, he's only entitled to Ziborit, and then the Chachamim upgraded him to Beinonit. The other hand, if you subscribe to Rabbi Shimon, then you're entitled to Idit, but the Chachamim downgraded you to Beinonit, so that you are not a predatory lender looking to take away the idit. And the machloket in the brightot here is whether you'll hold of ula or do you hold of Rabbi Shimon. What is the deoraita level that you should have collected versus what is the takanat chachamim, according to both of them, is benonit. But that means in a case where this guy only has benonit and ziborit, how do we view that? Do we view it as him having really idit and ziborit? He has idit and ziborit, then according to Rabbi Shimon, what do we do now? Versus what do you do according to ula? According to Rabbi Shimon, since a Baal Chov is entitled to take from idit, when he only has idit and ziborit, he will take from idit. On the other hand, for ula, who says that min HaTorah is ziborit, when he has idit and ziborit, he'll be pushed to the ziborit. So in this instance where he has a benonit and ziborit, and we're going to deem his benonit to be idit, so now you have idit and ziborit. In that scenario, which of those two properties is he entitled to? Is it the idit or the ziborit? If you hold like Rabbi Shimon, you're entitled to the idit. If you hold like ula, you're entitled to the ziborit. That's what it means. Do you hold like ula or do you not hold like ula? Meaning, what do you think the base doraita is? Ula says the base doraita is ziborit. Rabbi Shimon says that the base doraita is idit. And that'll make the difference in the braita. So those are three different ways to explain this. Tan Rabbanan. Machar le'achad, o l'shlosha b'nei adam ke'achad. Sold all of his property to one individual, or to three individuals simultaneously. Kulam nichnesu tachar avalim. They basically step into the shoes of the original owner. The zachar zeh, if he sold it sequentially, kulam govim in acharon. Then all the creditors come after the last person to buy, because we have a basic rule, which is that when there is unencumbered property, and encumbered property, we will tell you to take from the unencumbered property or from the free and clear property. So anything that the person's already sold, that's off limits, as long as there's property that's left behind. If there is not enough or sufficient property left behind, then you'll go after the people who already bought it and it's not free and clear property. So over here, where you bought the properties in a sequential manner, whatever is the last property to be sold is the first one that you're going to go to collect from. And though, if there's not enough or sufficient value in that last property, then you go to the property or the second last property that was sold. Ain't low. If there's not enough in that asset value of the last and the second to last, then you go to the third to last property. In the case where it's done sequentially, you go from the last property sold back towards the first property trying to collect. What's the case where he sold it to one individual? If he sold it in one shot, meaning simultaneously to this individual, Hashel l'shlosha, the ikal meimer chad minayu kadim. Here the Breita says that when you have three individuals, and you could argue that one of them preceded the other, amart kulam nichnasu tachar balim, you still say that they all step into the shoes of the balim. Machon echad mi bayit. Then when you sell them to one individual, you have to tell me that it's considered like one. Here you're taking three separate individuals and saying that they all have the same date and they are like the balim. So why do you have to tell me in a case of echad? El pshita b'zecher zeh. It's a case where he does it sequentially. So now, here you have three scenarios in the Braita. You have a scenario where he sells it to one individual sequentially. You have a scenario where he sells it to three different people simultaneously. And then you have a case where he sells it to the three people sequentially. Wait a minute, in that last scenario in the Braita where they three people buy it sequentially, there we said that each person can say, go to the guy after me, because he bought it later, and he's the last free and clear land that there was. You should go after and collect from that. Hainami, akol chad v'chad, leimalei, and achtil chamakom, legavot mimenu. So, so too, the guy, the single individual who bought from this individual in a sequential manner, he can also say, I bought this property first, I bought this property second, I bought this property last. You only have rights to go after that last property, because that was the last free and clear property. So, hachamai eskinan, yes, you're right, that is true. Just happens to be, gagon lochachi dit bachrona, he bought the best quality property last. So it's not to his advantage to invoke that principle, because if he says, take from the free and clear property, then they're all gonna go and take from the highest quality property, because that was the last free and clear property. So that's not to his advantage to make such a claim. He bought Edith last. So therefore, over here, you're going to have to take a different tact. So then, if that's the case, what would be the conclusion? They all should go and collect out of Edith. So again here, you have a Braita that says, if you sold property to three individuals simultaneously, and that doesn't mean necessarily that they all were sold in a single contract. It could be that they're sold in one contract. It could be they're sold in three different contracts. As long as the contracts have the same dating, then they are considered as if they were sold simultaneously. That's even if they were sold at different times during the day, but if they have the same date on them, then they're all considered to be simultaneous. And that is because we do not worry about sha'ot. We do not worry about hours, or we do not mark the hours inside of a contract, with the exception of Yerushalayim. We saw that previously in the Gemara. In Yerushalayim, they should mark the hours down. But in places where they don't mark the hours down, or in places where they don't mark them and somebody did mark the hours down, it does not make a difference because it has a single date in it. So if they were all sold on a single date, it's as if they were sold simultaneously. In that case, if he has three levels of property, Edith, Benonit, and Ziborit, and he has three claimants, he has a Nizak that wants his Nezek paid, he has a creditor that's looking to get paid, and an Isha that wants to Tubat Isha. So in that case, if they had come to the original owner, the Nizak would get Edith, the Baal Chov would get Benonit, and the Isha, the Ketubat Isha, would come out of the Ziborit. So too, when he sells them to the three parties, they're sold with the lien on them. And since they were sold simultaneously, nobody has an advantage in terms of saying, no, you go collect from that one or collect from this one. They have to all go after the particular land that they have the lien on. And therefore, the Nizak will go after the buyer who bought the Edith. The Baal Chov will go after the buyer who bought the Benonit. And the Ketubat Isha will go after the one who bought the Ziborit. That's in a case where it's simultaneous. In a case of Zecher Zeh, in a case where it's done sequentially, then we have a scenario in which the individual can say, when I bought it, there was still free and clear property left behind. And that's part of this whole idea here, that when you're a buyer, you want to leave sufficient collateral behind with the person you're purchasing from, so that all outstanding debts will be taken out of the property you leave behind. So you think and you say, listen, there are outstanding debts of such and such an amount. I'm going to buy this property knowing that the property I left behind can cover all of those debts. In that case, we're not going to allow the creditors here, whoever they are, to come after the one who bought the property because he left sufficient free and clear property behind to collect from. The next buyer comes and says, look, I'm going to buy this. I still see sufficient assets left to pay off all of his debts. So he buys that. And then you have a third buyer who comes along and says, I think it's even smaller. Turns out that the claims were bigger than anybody thought. So the way that you go to collect is you first go to the debtor himself and collect whatever free and clear property it is then. Then you go after that, sequentially, you'll go through each property that was the last one to be sold. The last property that is sold has the weakest position over here because they were last to be free and clear property. So whatever property was sold last will be the first to be taken to pay the creditors. If that's not sufficient, then they'll go after the property that was sold once before that, or once before that. So that's the scenario here. The Gemara says if it's one individual or three individuals, why does it make a difference whether when it's sequentially that they both have the same claim? Go take from the last property I bought. The Gemara says, Enochanami, you're right. Whether it's an individual or three individuals, they both can make the same claim, which is the last property I bought is the most exposed to the creditors. So why in this case? What's so special here? Here's a case where the last thing they bought was the best quality property. So now it's not to the advantage of the purchaser to have them go and collect out of the last property. Because for him, that means that they're all going to come and collect from the best quality property, and all he's going to be left with is the Benonit and Ziborit. So he doesn't want that. He wants them to collect based on what their real lien is. He wants the one who got damaged to collect maybe out of Idit, the Balchov out of Benonit, or the Ktuvet Ishad of Ziborit. He doesn't want them all collecting from the Idit. In the case where you have three different buyers, you don't have a choice. Because the three buyers are not going to collude together. And therefore, the two first buyers say, take it from the third buyer. We don't care. It's not us. We're not going to lose. And even if it's Idit, they say to him, collect everything from that third buyer, because at least we preserve our properties or what we bought. On the other hand, when it's a single buyer, he loses no matter what. What he loses is important to him. He's going to lose property here. He'd rather lose the lowest quality property rather than the highest quality property. But Minadin, they have a right to collect from the Idit, because that was the last free and clear property. So that's what the Gemara wants to know now. If that is the last free and clear property, why does this individual have a right to tell him, no, you're not going to take from the Idit, you're going to take from something else? What right does he have to say that? The Takana of the Chachamim is, if you have free and clear property, you go after that. If he bought the Idit last, that was the last free and clear property, they should have the right, or their liens should be connected to it and come and collect from that property. The answer of the Gemara is, Mishom Damar Lahu, he can say to them, Ishat kitu vishaklitu kidin aichu. If you guys go ahead and take what I'm offering you, shaklitu, you'll be fine. Ilo, if not, madrana shtara de ziborit de mare, I'm gonna go and cancel the transaction with regards to the ziborit. Shaklitu kuchu mi ziborit. All of you are gonna collect from ziborit. What he in essence is saying is, I bought all three properties now. The last property I bought was Idit. Technically, you guys all have a claim against the Idit property because that was the last free and clear property. But he can also change the dynamic over here. He can change the dynamic by canceling the sale of the Ziborit. That's the way Tosafot says. Literally, he's going to rip up the contract for the Ziborit, and that will return the Ziborit to the original owner. And now all the creditors have only a right to go after Ziborit because that's free and clear property with the creditor now. So this one buyer bought all three properties. He's going to rip up the Ziborit contract and say, I never bought the Ziborit. Go back to the owner. He has Ziborit and free and clear property. You have no rights to come after my property. So he can threaten them with that. And because he can threaten them with that, he can force them to take what they rightfully would get based on a regular layout of Idit, Benonit, and Ziborit. That's the way Tosafot looks at it. There are Rishonim, like the Ramban, and others who say that ripping up the contract won't do anything because the transaction happened already. Ripping up the contract's just a proof text. It's not the Kinyan anymore. So they say that you have to gift it. He would gift that Ziborit back to the original owner, and by doing that, he now has free and clear property from which to collect. So they see it as being more of an active thing that he would do. He'd gift it back to the original owner versus the case Tosafot, who thinks it's just simply a ripping up of the contract. That's number one. Number two is, Tosafot asks over here, why does the Nizak, why does the one who was damaged have any rights of collection over here? Because his rights of collection come from the Torah, but he has no contract. Why does he have a lien on this property at all? He's just a, what we call, milve al peh. He has an oral commitment, which is that the guy did damage, now he owes him money. He doesn't have any shtar, he doesn't have any lien on the property. If he collected from his property, he could collect from Idit. But once the property's gone, where's his lien? So Tosafot comes up with two possibilities of how he has a lien here. Either Kashamad Bedin, He already went to court to collect it, and when the court paskin in his favor, that automatically puts a lien on the property. Or it's a case or based on the mandamar that says, milvek tuva b'torah is kishtar damyo. If it's something that's written in the Torah, it's equivalent of holding a shtar. Over here, the necessity to pay for the nezek is a din min haTorah. And so since he's coming with a quote-unquote shtar of the Torah, he has a lien on the property. So that's first of all how the nisak has a lien. The second thing here is that you have to look at the different options of how he's able to threaten these individuals over here. For the woman, there's nothing to threaten her with. She would get ziborit, that's her real claim. And if he returns the shtar, she'll get ziborit. So for her, it's worth rolling the dice and saying, okay, I want the edit that you bought last. If you don't want me to take from that edit, go ahead and give the property back to the original owner. She can call his bluff because she has nothing to lose. She would have collected a ziburit anyway. And she'd call his bluff. You want to give the property back? I'll get my ziburit. That's fine. If you don't, I'm going to take from the edit. So as far as she's concerned, it's not a threat. As far as the Nizak is concerned, he has a real threat over here, which is he can say to him, listen, take Beinonit instead of Edit. You, the Nizak, you're entitled to Edit. But what I'm going to say to you is take Beinonit, take a one-step downgrade, because if you don't accept the Beinonit from me, I'm going to return the shtar and you're going to get Ziborit. So that's really a threat to that individual, because he really is entitled to Edit. That the guy is saying to him, you're not getting Edit, period. You have a choice now. You can either take the Beinonit that I'm offering you, or if you don't accept that, I'm going to return the Ziborit to the original owner, and then you're going to get Ziborit. So I'm telling you, you're better off taking Beinonit now, because I'm going to threaten you by giving it back, and you're going to have to take Ziborit. So he holds the sway over this individual, because he can say, take a one-step downgrade to Beinonit, because if you don't, I'm going to return the shtar, and you're going to get Ziborit. So he has a way to threaten the individual. The question is, by the Baal Chov, the case of the Beinonit, does he really have a threat? Rashi says that you could have said the same thing to the Baal Chov, but the threat isn't really a good threat. Or in other words, he looks more like the Isha and the Ketubah, which is that you're called the bluff. Because what he's going to say over here, look, you're entitled to Beinonit. Instead of taking Beinonit, I'm going to give you Ziborit. Okay, so you give me Ziborit. So the guy says, if you don't take Ziborit, I'm going to return the shtar to the original owner. There was Ziborit anyway. What's the difference? Meaning that his threat is to give him Ziborit. And he says, if you don't take the Ziborit, I'm going to return the shtar. In that case, the guy's going to call the bluff and say, go ahead, return the shtar. Let's see you return the shtar. Because he's going to get Ziborit in either case. He's going to get Ziborit because he's threatening to give him Ziborit instead of Beinonit. Or he's saying to him, otherwise I'll return the shtar and you'll get Ziborit. So he's indifferent. Meaning the threat as well as the ramifications are both Ziborit. So in that case, Rashi says, and Tosafot seconds over here, that in Ochanami, you could ask this about the Baal Chov as well, but in the end, in that case, he has nothing to lose. He's going to call the bluff. So that's the way that they learn it. The truth is that he might, or the way that you could structure it with the Baal Chov is to say to the Baal Chov, listen, take Beinonit. You're really, now you're claiming a claim from the Edit, because that was the last free, clear property. I'm telling you, you're better off taking from the Beinonit, because if you don't, I'll return the contract to the owner, and then you're going to get Ziborit. In that case, it is a real threat to the Baal Chov. But the way that we have it structured here is that he's trying to force the Nizak to take lower property, not the Edit, which he really is entitled to, and he's trying to take it down. And that's what Rashi and Tosafot seem to be indicating over here. He's trying to move these people from their right to a lower level. So he's trying to take the Nizak from Edit down to Beinonit. He's trying to take the Baal Chov from Beinonit down to Ziborit. And the Ketubat Isha is already Ziborit. In all of those instances, they can call his bluff, both by the Baal Chov and the Ketubat Isha, because they have nothing to lose. The only one that had really something to lose is the Nizak, and that's why Rashi says that the Gemara continues with the Nizak, because that's the one where there's real ramifications. Iochi, if that's the case, B'Nizakin, Nami Neimaochi. B'Nizakin, he should also say this. But the fact that the Braita does not bring this down, that cannot be the scenario, which is the Gemara is suggesting that all sounds nice, but that's not what's found in the Braita. The Braita never says that he's threatening the Nizak or that he's threatening any of the parties. Because the Braita says that he gets Ketikunan. What's Tikunan? That means that the Nizak gets Edit, the Baal Chov gets Beinonit, and the Ketubat gets Ziborit. Well, what do you mean Ketikunan? If you have this threat that you can make, then the Nizak should not get Nidit, he should be able to be downgraded to Beinonit. He has a way to force this guy to take lower class property. The fact that the Braita never mentions that shows you that that's not the mechanism that he's using in order to get out of the problem. Ben Ochanan says the main claim of the Gemara here in asking from the Nizakin is that Gemara's original assumption is that he forces them to take a dinam, which is that the Nizak will take Idit, and the Balchov will take Benonit, and the Ketubat Isha will take Ziborit. Then the Gemara says, if he's already making that claim, he can go further and make a claim and say he'll force them all to take from Ziborit, Shalo Kedinam, not according to their din. And so that's what the Gemara is asking over here by Nizakin and Kol Shekin by Balchov. If he's saying, you know what, no Idit for you, no Benonit for you, Ziborit for you, all of you, Ziborit for all of you, that is actually what could come out of this same claim. And that's why the Gemara sets it up in a case where he can't make that claim, because Gemara is loath to accept this type of taina, because it won't lead to not only for them getting what they are entitled to, it'll actually downgrade their rights over here, and that the Gemara was not comfortable with. The Gemara says, talking about here, Yutomim. And since they are Yutomim, they do not have to pay. The lien is on the property that he bought, and the Yutomim have no obligations over here, because Shibudei Alei Ramya, the lien is on that which he owns, and not that which resides with the Yutomim. Or in essence, what the Gemara is saying here is, if you have Yutomim, Yutomim are responsible to make payments for obligations that their father entered into, with their father's assets. They do not have an obligation to make whole on their father's debts from their own assets or from their own resources. They're only obligated to do it out of the assets of the father. So if there's property that the father left, or property that they collect that was owed to their father, then the liens will apply to it, and those creditors could come after that property. So if the Yutomim inherit land from their father, the creditors could come and collect from that land. If the Yutomim have claims against other parties from their father, and then there are also claims against them, if they collect those claims that they have from their father, then the people who have claims against the father can come and collect those properties, because they're all part of the father's estate. Over here, what's happening, and this works better according to the Shita of the Ramban, is that you're giving property to the Yutomim. The property that you're giving to the Yutomim has nothing to do with the father's assets, or not really from a claim of the father. You're simply ripping up the contract. So now, according to the Ramban, says you're gifting it to the Yutomim, it makes a lot of sense why these creditors will have no right to go after that property, because this isn't a part of the father's estate. This is a gift being given to the Yutomim. Even if you think like the Balei Tosafot, which is that you're ripping up the original contract and the land is going back to the Yutomim, over there again, the liens of those parties, it's not coming to the Yutomim because of their father. It's coming to the Yutomim because the buyer decided to rip up the contract. And so that money that comes to Yutomim, you can't go and collect out of. And so that's why this whole scenario won't work over here, is because you're dealing with the Yutomim. And in dealing with the Yutomim, even if you rip up the contract, it's not going to be a threat. Because even if you rip up the contract and give it back to the Yutomim, the creditors won't be able to go after that property. They're going to come after you anyway. They're going to come after your property. So giving the property back will do nothing for you in this scenario. There is some, like the Rashbo suggests, but Yat Medalab Pirvei Binonin, who is talking about Yutomim Ktanim. Talking about Ktanim here, and that's why you can't go after them. But for whatever reason, the creditors are not going to be able to go after the Yutomim. If the creditors can't go after the Yutomim, then giving back the property to the Yutomim is not going to be a threat. You could say, listen, either you take from this or I'm giving it back to the Yutomim. They say, go ahead, give it back to the Yutomim. We're still coming after your property, because the property you give the Yutomim is not going to give us a vehicle for collection. We're not going to be able to collect there. And so that's why that's not the explanation of this Braita. Ella, so what is the case here? Shem damar lohu, he can say to them, Taima mai amur rabbanan. What is the reason that the rabbanan say, Ein nifraim nechasim mishubadim b'makom sheyesh b'nei chorim? Why did the rabbanan establish a takana that you must go after free and clear property first, and then only after property that was already sold or encumbered to someone else? Mishum takanta didi. The buyer says, listen, it's for my protection. The whole takanat chachamim here was put in place for my protection, which is when I buy property and I leave behind assets, then you're not going to come after my property. You're going to go after those assets I left behind instead of taking what I have. So it was we'll call it a takanat ha-shuk. It was a marketplace takana that said in order to protect buyers, When I say that buyers, as long as they make an astute and reasonable assumption when they buy something and leave behind assets to collect from, in most cases, they're going to be protected because they left sufficient assets behind in the estate to get the collections from. So that's the takanat chachamim. But that takanat chachamim is done for the protection of the buyer. Ana baha takanta lo nechali. Over here, this takana is not working in my favor. Because I bought the Benoni Ziburit and then the Edit, which makes it that you guys can all come and collect that of the Edit now, because that was the last free and clear property. At this point, that's not to my advantage. That's not helping me out that I have that takanat chachamim. I'm going to decline. I'm going to waive the takanat chachamim. Again, I always compare this to a penalty in football, where in the play in the football, they did better than the penalty would afford them. You decline the penalty. Same thing over here. The buyer says, I'm in a better position if I do not subscribe to this takanat chachamim. The takanat chachamim is put in for my advantage. So if I don't need it, I'm going to waive the takanat chachamim. Kidderava. Dama Rava, Kolomeri Yefshi b'takanat chachamim. Anyone who says, I decline the takanat chachamim, konzo, like this, Shomimla, we listen to him. Mike Gonzo, what's the example that he's bringing where we say that you can decline the takanat chachamim? Kidravuna, Dama Ravuna, we saw this many times in Ketubot. Yachola Isha Shateyamer Lebala, a woman can say to her husband, Eini nizonit ve'eni osa. I don't want nizonot from you, but you're also not going to get my masse yadayim. The chachamim instituted a takana for the advantage of the woman or for the benefit of the woman that she will get mizonot from her husband, and she will give him her masa yadayim. The reason that it's to her advantage is that even if her masa yadayim don't equal her mizonot, she's still entitled to the mizonot. But in a scenario where the woman sees her masa yadayim far exceed the mizonot she's getting, she might make a decision to waive the takanat chachamim and say, Eini osa ve'eini mizonit. I'm not going to take mizonot for you, but I'm also not going to give you masa yadayim. I'm going to keep them because the takanah was for my benefit. Over here, it's not to my benefit. Therefore, I'm going to decline or waive the takanat chachamim. Similarly, over here, the buyer can say the same thing. The takanat chachamim is not helping me. Since it's not helping me, I'm going to waive it. Now, that only works in a case where he's the buyer of all the properties, because the entirety of those rights are accrue to him. Which is when he bought the first property, the second property, and the third property, it kept pushing the liens onto the free and clear property. When he buys the last piece of property, again, it's still only him who is the beneficiary of the takanat chachamim. So if it doesn't help him, he can waive it. On the other hand, when you have three different individuals buying it sequentially, the last guy can't say, you know what, the takanat chachamim is not good for me. I want you to go collect from all the other property because this free and clear business is not to my advantage. He can't do that because then he's disadvantaging the two first buyers. For the first two buyers, it is to their advantage to have that takana. So in that case, you will not waive the takana, and you go after the last guy who bought the property. Everybody will collect from the last one who bought, because that was the last free and clear property. It's only when the one guy bought all three properties, and everything is done to his advantage, over there where it's not to his advantage, he can waive the takanat chachamim. Now the Gemara says, Pshita, this case, we're clear on what the halacha is. Machar lokeach benonit v'ziborit v'she'er idit lefanav. The lokeach, the person who purchased the property. Here he bought all the property owned by this individual, the idit, the benonit, and ziborit. Then he sold the benonit v'ziborit, and he left the idit with himself. Leitu kulo v'ligvu mi'idit. All of them can come and collect from the idit. Da'achronahi, because that's the last property that was sold. U'benonit v'ziborit, let nehu gabe. The benonit and ziborit are not in his hand. The matzah the memelu gavi mi benonit v'ziborit. So you can't now make them and say, go collect out of the benonit and ziborit. So no lekli b'takanta derabonon. That I don't like the takanta derabonon. It's not helpful to me in this instance. So therefore, you guys should go get the benonit and ziborit. The problem is, he doesn't have the benonit and ziborit anymore. The buyer brought idit, benonit and ziborit, then sold again the benonit and ziborit. All he's left in hand with is the idit. The idit was the last thing that he bought, and now it's the only thing left in his hand. He has no claim here, because when the guys come to collect, they say, that's the last free and clear property. We're going to come and collect out of the idit. He says, listen, you know, I don't like this takanat chachamim over here, because it's not helping me. He can't say that, because he doesn't have the benonit and ziborit left with him in order to force them to take it. He can't send them to the other buyers, because he gave up those rights to those buyers. And therefore, in this case, they'll go after his idit, and he has no way out of it. Aval, what happens in a case where machar idit, v'shier benonit v'ziborit? He sold the best property, but he left with himself the benonit v'ziborit. Savar abayla meymar, atakulu gabu mi idit. Everybody can go after the Idit, which means that they go after the new buyer. The buyer who bought the Idit off the original buyer, they're going to all go after him because that was the last free and clear property. So Abaye says over here, again, he can't make the claim, but the claim goes in his favor now, which is that in the first case, he had left the Idit with himself and sold everything else onward. So they're going to go after the Idit, and that's to his disadvantage. In this case, where he sold the Idit and kept the other stuff, it's to his advantage that the Takanat Chachamim stay in place, and since it'll stay in place, they'll go after the second buyer who bought the Idit off of the first buyer. So Mez Amalei Rava, wait a minute, this is a principle that we have everywhere. Mamachar Rishon L'Sheni, Kol Zchut She'Tavah L'Yado. That when you sell property, you sell the property with all the embedded rights that you have in that property. It's not simply you sell the property, you sell the property along with the rights. Now, there are two sides to this, which is, number one, you can't sell more rights than you have, but you can also can't diminish the rights that you had in the property. Whatever rights you had, that's what's going to be sold on to the next guy. The cave in Ilu Atu Gabe Lokeach Rishon, how they come to the first buyer, Motzi Agvelu Mi Benonit V'Ziborit, so he could force them to take from the Benonit and Ziborit, even though the Idit was the last free and clear property that he bought. Even though when he was purchasing them, he purchased it first, Benonit, Ziborit, and then Idit, and Idit was the last free and clear property. Since you don't go after encumbered property when there's free and clear property, he can say to them, he can say, I don't like this takana. Therefore, lokeach sheni nami matzi amar lehu. The so too, the second buyer can say the same thing. Gavi, Benonit v'ziborit, go collect from the Benonit v'ziborit. T'chizav en lokeach sheni, adaita d'chol zchuta d'avad rishon b'gava azavin. When he purchased it assuming that he would have the same rights as the original buyer. So what Rava says over here is, in this scenario, which seemingly is just the other side of the coin of the first scenario. In the first scenario, Reuven bought property that was Idit, Ziborit, and Benonit from a individual who had all these creditors outstanding with him. He then sells to Shimon the Benonit and Ziborit, and all he's left behind with him is the Idit. Well, the Gemara says over there, all the guys come and collect out of the Idit because Idit was the last free and clear property. Since the last free and clear property, that's their right to collect out of the Idit. He can't say, I don't like the Takanat Chachamim here anymore because he doesn't have the Benonit and Ziborit with him. He already sold that to Shimon. So Reuven has no claim. He has to give up the Idit to the creditors. The other hand, when it's reversed, where he sold the Idit to Shimon, and Reuven kept the Benonit and Ziborit, Abaye suggests it should be the same scenario. The creditors have a claim against the Idit because that was the last property sold. Whoever's holding the Idit is the one who gets hurt here. So in this case, it'll be Shimon because the second buyer is the one holding the Idit. Reuven says, that's not true. Because over here, it's a different scenario. When he sells the Idit to that buyer, when Reuven sells it to Shimon after buying it or purchasing it as the last purchase, he sold him the same rights that he had in that property. His rights in that property are, if he has Idit, Benit, and Ziborit, he can force the creditors to go after their Benit and Ziborit and not the Idit. Because he says, listen, I don't want the Takanat Chachamim here. So since he can make that claim, when he sold that to Shimon, he sold him that right also to make such a claim. Since he sold that right to Shimon, Shimon can also exercise that right and say, listen, I'm not interested in the Takanat Chachamim. It's not helpful to me. Then you have to go collect that Benonit and Ziborit from Reuven. Ain't Achanami. Because when Reuven sold this to Shimon, he sold him the right to make that claim. And when he had the right to make that claim, he can force Reuven to be responsible for it. And their Baal Chov and the Ketubat Isha will have to go and collect out of the Benonit and the Ziborit. So that's how Rava rejects Abaye's explanation of this being the same on both sides. But rather, in this case, the Idit that is sold to Shimon will not be encumbered to all the creditors, even though that was the last free and clear property, because Shimon has the same rights as Reuven. If it was sitting in Reuven's hands, he'd have the right to reject the Takanat Chachamim or waive the Takanat Chachamim. So too Shimon has that same right. Amar Rava. Now a new scenario. Reuven shemachar kol sdotav l'Shimon. Reuven sold all of his property to Shimon. Valach Shimon amachar steachat Levi. Then Shimon went and sold one of those properties to Levi. Ubal b'chov to Reuven. And then Reuven's creditor shows up. Ratza mizegove, ratza mizegove. He can choose whom he wishes to collect from. Below Amran el dezavin benonit. That's only true if Levi bought middle range property. So since he bought middle range property, Beinonit, the creditor has a right to come and collect from Beinonit. He can collect from the Beinonit that's sitting in Shimon's hands, or he can collect from the Beinonit that's sitting in Levi's hands. His lien on the Beinonit is any Beinonit of Reuven, the original owner, is encumbered to the creditor. So now when Shimon buys it, he buys it with that lien. When Shimon sells it to Levi, he also sells it with that lien on it. And therefore now where Shimon and Levi each own a portion of the Beinonit of Reuven, the Baal Chov has the right to go after either of those parties. Aval Zavani Divi Ziborit. On the other hand, if he's purchased, Levi's purchases a property from Shimon, where only the Yedid and Ziborit, lo, then the creditor cannot go after Levi. Because, Damarle, he can say to the creditor, V'hochi Daiki V'zavne Yedid V'Ziborit. I purposely bought only the Yedid and Ziborit, Ara de lo Chazilach, stuff that you don't have a right to collect from, or your lien is not on that property. So in a case where Levi buys Beinonit, then he can't push the creditor away because he bought property that has a lien on it from the creditor. So in that case, the creditor can choose if he wants to go after Levi or after Shimon. There's Beinonit property from Reuven being held by both of them. He can go after either or both of them because that's Beinonit property. On the other hand, if Levi buys Yedid and Ziborit and leaves the Beinonit behind with Shimon, he can say to him, listen, your Beinonit is sitting there. That's where your lien is. Don't come after me looking for Yedid and Ziborit because I purposely bought those so that you wouldn't come after me and you'd go to the Beinonit that I left behind with Shimon. Tosfot says over here that this claim is only, or this issue is only relevant by the Ziborit. By the Yedid, it's clear that he can say to him, I bought the Yedid and I left behind Beinonit and Ziborit. You have no right to come after me with the Yedid. With the Ziborit, it's not as clear. And this is based on the sheet of Tosafot, which matches the sheet of Rashi earlier on, which is that the creditor gets the right to choose which property he wants. I mean, the Takanat Chachamim was that he gets to collect from Beinonit. Can he collect more property of Ziborit if he so chooses? Rashi, and here the Balei Tosafot say the same thing, is that it's up to the Baal Chov. He can choose what he wants to collect from. If he wants Beinonit, he can take Beinonit. If he wants to go back to the Doraita Din, he can collect Ziborit. We saw the Rosh in yesterday's Gemara who disagreed with that and said it's up to the Mazik or here, it's up to the debtor which one he wants to give. Now based on that, Tosafot says, listen, if he bought Yedid, it's clear that the creditor has no right to collect from this Yedid, so he has to go after the Beinonit and Ziborit over here. But in a case where he buys the Ziborit as well, then this issue comes up. Because the Baal Chov has a right to collect from Beinonit and to collect from Ziborit. So in that case, he can say to him, listen, I have a right to pick. If I want the Beinonit, I'll go after Shimon. If I want the Ziborit, I'm going to go after Levi. In that case, Levi has this claim, and that's what Tosafot says, that this reason, when he says, I went out of my way to buy the Ziborit and the Yedid because I wanted to leave Beinonit behind, that claim is strong enough to tell him you can't come after the Ziborit now. Even though you're entitled to make that choice, once it's already been sold to Levi, you have to go after Shimon first in the Beinonit, and you can't say, look, I'll choose Beinonit from Shimon and Ziborit from Levi. Again, if he bought the Yedid, doesn't matter, because he doesn't have any right to the Yedid, and whatever Levi bought in the Yedid is not a claim that, oh, I bought stuff that you don't have a right to. No. The case is where he bought the Ziborit, which technically has a claim to, but it's not really the primary asset that is encumbered to the Baal Chov. And therefore, you can say to him, I left you Beinonit to collect from, don't come after my Ziborit. Even though technically, had Shimon been holding Beinonit and Ziborit, the creditor could decide to take either one of them. Little more Ziborit, little less Beinonit, it would be up to him. The reason that Levi has to make a claim here is that I bought stuff that's not related to you is to protect the Ziborit. Get according to the Rosh, who says that it's up to the debtor, not up to the creditor, then the creditor has no claim on the Ziborit, and you just read this, that he bought Yedid and Ziborit in order to prevent the creditor from coming after him at all, and he'd have to go after the Beinonit. The Gemara says, Va'afilu Zavan Beinonit Nami. Also, even if Levi bought Beinonit, lo amar nelo delo shir Beinonit to kavate. That he didn't leave behind Beinonit that was on an equal level or on par with the Beinonit that he bought. Because then he can say, I left you enough space to collect out of Shimon. That's why I bought only this amount of Beinonit. So I left behind enough assets for you to collect out of. Valshir Beinonit to Kavate Gabi Shimon. If you left equal level quality Beinonit property with Shimon, Lo Gabi Minei. He can't come after Levi. I left you sufficient grounds to collect from Shimon, and therefore don't come after me, Levi, because I left behind, it's not free and clear property anymore, but I left behind property with the first buyer that was sufficient to cover your claims. As Tosfos points out over here, his claim to say that I left behind property is not a real claim, because here we're talking about two buyers. The only time you say that I left you makom to collect from is when you left property with the balim, with the original owners, that's free and clear. Over here, where it's a multi-level of purchases, where Shimon bought from Reuven and Levi bought from Shimon, Levi can't say, listen, I left you makom by Shimon. That's not relevant. That's also encumbered property. So as Tosfos points out, that's not the main reason, even though that's what the Gemara writes. That's not the main reason here of an Akhtav HaMakom, but rather, the main reason is what we said above, that Kol Zchut, that the first guy has, he sold to the second guy. And just like that, Zchut, had he had all the properties together, he could have forced the Baal Chov to take Benonit. So too, when he sells the Idit and Ziborit to the Levi, or even the Benonit to Levi, then Levi can exercise the same rights that Shimon would exercise. And just like over here, if he leaves sufficient ground behind with Shimon, he can say, that's my zchut, my right is to push you to Shimon, because he sold me the rights to force the Baal Chov to take from the Benonit that was left behind. And since the original buyer, Shimon, can force him to take whatever Benonit it is, as long as it's equal level, so too the second buyer, Levi, can do the same thing and say, there's equal quality Benonit by Shimon, go take it from Shimon, don't take it from me. So in that case, if it was just because of an Akhtav HaMakom, then the Baal Chov could go after Benonit or Ziborit, since according to the Baal HaTosafot, it's up to him. Whereas when you use the, invoke the principle of Ma Machar Rishon L'Sheni, Kol Zchut She'Tavod Yado, in that case, he can force him to go after the Benonit that he left behind, and not the Ziborit that he purchased. Amar Abayi, Reuven She'Machar Sadeh L'Shimon Be'Achrayut. If Reuven sold property to Shimon with a warranty on it, Ba'ata Baal Chov Du Reuven, and now the creditor of Reuven comes along, the taraf mi Shimon, and takes away the property from Shimon. Dinuhu da'azo Reuven u'mishtai dina ba'dei. Reuven has a right to go to court against the creditor over here. Lo matzi amarle, and the creditor can't say to Reuven, lav ba'al b'dvarim didiat. You're not a party to this transaction. You're not a party to this transaction because you sold the property already. My lien is on the property. I'm going after the property. Shimon's the owner of that property. He and I have a date in court. But you, Reuven, you're out of the picture now. That he can't say to him, Damarle, because Reuven will say to him, Imafkat mine alai hadar. If you take that property away from Shimon, Shimon is going to come and he's going to exercise his recourse and come after me for the property. So I am a party to this transaction because if Shimon loses the property, Shimon's going to come back to me, Reuven, and try to exercise his recourse and collect. Vika damre, afilu shalo b'achrayut nami. Even if he doesn't put a warranty in the contract, because he can say, I don't want Shimon to have complaints against me. So even if there's no recourse here, and the property's taken from Shimon, Shimon's out the money. But Reuven knows that Shimon brought him from him, and Reuven knows if that property gets taken away from Shimon, Shimon's not going to be a happy camper. He's not going to do business with him anymore, and he's going to have a real taina against Reuven for selling him property that had liens on it. So because of that, Reuven is also a party to the transaction here, because even if Shimon is the one who's going to take the real loss, Reuven will have a direct loss or consequence from this, which is that he's going to lose his reputation in this, and therefore he wants to protect his reputation, therefore he becomes a party to the transaction. Now Tosafot asks over here, why do we need Reuven at all? Shimon can make whatever claims he wants. And if Shimon doesn't have a claim, Beit Din will step in and make the claims on behalf of Shimon that Reuven could have made. So Shimon can make the claim, or Beit Din will make the claim on behalf of Shimon, whatever claim Reuven could have made. So what does Reuven add to the picture that we want, or we give him the right to be a party to this transaction? Tosafot says it doesn't seem like he's additive. So Tosafot gives two possibilities as to how Reuven is additive over here. One is the case of Raya Achrona, which is a Mishnah in Sanhedrin, which says they give him a fixed amount of time to bring all of his evidence to the court. So in that case, if Shimon was given a time limit in which to bring all of his evidence to the court, and he missed that date, Reuven could still bring evidence into the case because he was never held to that date by which he had to bring in all of the evidence. That's one case where Reuven could trump Shimon, even though Beit Din would make claims for him, there Reuven can now enter those claims where Shimon cannot enter those claims. Or in a scenario where The creditor says, I want to go to the Beit Din HaGadol. I want to go to either the Makom Avad in Bavel, or I want to go to the Beit Din HaGadol in Yerushalayim. I want to adjudicate this in the big courts. I don't want to go to one of these little courts, the common three-man courts. I want to go to the big courts. So he can compel the debtor to follow him there. In a case where Shimon can't afford to go there, or he can't afford the time to go there, then Reuven could come in and go to the court, or pay for the expenses to go to the court in order to adjudicate the case. So there's a case where Shimon wouldn't be able to do it, but Reuven could step in and fill in for him because he's a party to the case. So that's how Tosafot gives two cases where, even though generally Beit Din will give the same claims that Reuven could have asked, still there are nafkamina when Reuven's a party to the case, like in these scenarios where he could add value that Shimon couldn't have added before. The Ramban simply says that Reuven is a better litigator than Shimon. And that's the reason that Reuven wants to go into court, because he's just a better litigator. It has nothing to do with the claim that he has better than Shimon, but his persuasive talents are much better, and that's why he wants to be involved in the case. Now, as far as Reuven's obligation to get involved in the case, the Netziv in the Merom Meisadah says that it's an obligation for Reuven to intervene and to work on behalf of keeping the property with Shimon, although most Rishonim believe that it's optional, meaning that he has the right to do it, but he does not have an obligation to enter into the case, because in the end, Shimon has recourse against Reuven, and if something happens, he'll come back to Reuven. So it's Reuven's option whether he wants to defend the position while Shimon still has the property, or whether he wants to just pay for it once the Shimon comes to him with the recourse. Am Rabbi, Reuven shemachar sadeh leShimon shelo be'achrayut. If Reuven sells a field to Shimon without recourse, v'yatzu aleha asikin, then all of a sudden there are orerim, as Rashi says, Tosafot seconds that, there are people that are saying that the land didn't belong to him. He sold land which he had no title to, and we are the real owners of the land. So they're basically coming in with claims. As Tosafot point out, this can't be a case of anes. Can't be a case of anasim, a case where there are strong men who come and confiscate the property from you, because the reason they confiscate the property has nothing to do with Reuven. It's basically bad luck. And now that they're confiscating the property from Shimon, it's his bad luck. It has nothing to do with Reuven. And in that case, Reuven would consider him mazal chagaram. Your bad luck caused the problem. I'm not responsible for this at all. Whereas in the case where these asikim show up, and they're making a claim on the property saying that Reuven stole it or Reuven never bought it from them, then they're really making a direct claim against Reuven. In that case, the cause of the loss of property to Shimon is Reuven. And here many Rishonim take this very literally, that which Rashi says, because if it's someone coming along and saying they have a lien on the land, that's part of the regular risks in a transaction. On the other hand, here we have Orerim coming along and say that the seller never had rights to sell the property. That's something that is not considered to be a normal risk. It's something that the party will back out of the transaction for if he still has a right to do so. And so Shimon can say, actually, exik ba, yachol lachzorbo. Before he does a chazakah, he can back out of the transaction if these rumors start to swirl or circulate, or these guys show up making a claim against the property. Meshech hezik ba, once he does the chazakah, and yachol lachzorbo. He can't back out of it. My taima. Because he can say to him, Damerlei, chaita de katre, savart v'kabalt, that you basically bought a bag of hot air. You knew it was a bag of hot air, and you bought it. You understood it, you saw it, you knew what you were getting into, and you decided you wanted to buy it anyway. So once he's taken possession of it, the guy says, you get what you bought. And whatever you bought is nothing. And you knew that, and you accepted it. So in that case, he can't back out of it. As Rashi, what's chaita de katre is a flask that has knots in it, which is basically a leather canteen that is knotted to or stitched to make it so that it holds whatever liquids are inside of it. And he's saying you basically got a bag of air. Meimetai avi chazaka. When does the chazaka kick in? Chidayish amitzrei. When he walks the boundaries of the property. All this is true when he doesn't have recourse here. That's what he can say. If there is recourse, Shimon can say to him, listen, take it back now, because I don't want to deal with this later when they come, and you're going to have to take it from you. Some say, even if it was sold with recourse, Reuven can say to Shimon, show me the document of confiscation, and then I'll pay you. And he says, you hold on to the property. If these guys show up and they have a real claim here, then I'll pay you back. I'll fulfill my obligations under the recourse in the document. But until that time, I'm not going to give you money now. I'm not going to take it back because I don't know if these claims are real. I don't even think these claims are real. And so based on that, even if he was sold to Achrayut, he would have to keep it. The buyer cannot back out of it. And if it gets taken from him, then he can exercise his recourse against the seller. But until that point in time, he doesn't have a right to exercise that recourse. Once he's Daisha Mitzray, once he walked the borders, he can't back out of the transaction. We said maybe that's only true when there's no recourse. Because when there's no recourse, his backing out of the transaction hurts the seller, and the seller doesn't have any obligation towards this buyer. So then, if he has achrayut, if he sold it with recourse, then in the end, the seller is on the hook for this. So the buyer can say to him, it doesn't matter that I was Daisha Mitzray, it doesn't matter that I walked the boundaries of the field, I don't want this property, and anyway, I have a claim against you because you sold it with recourse. So take it back now. The Ikudamri says, even if you sold it with recourse, you're going to say to him, I'm not taking it back now. When they come and they go to Beit Din and they get a proof and they get the property, come with that information which says, I owe you the recourse. Until that point in time, don't bother me about it. It's what's sold is sold and it's done over here. Now here there's a major machloket about what is exactly going on in this scenario. Because it says here, Mishechek Zikba. He made a chazok on it. What chazokah did he make over here? And what is exactly transpiring in the case that he can back out of it? So Rashi claims, it's not here, it's Rashi and Boba Metzia, says that he didn't pay money yet. He didn't pay for the land yet. It was nicknamed b'chazokah. It was purchased through a chazokah, and that's the chazokah here. Daisha Mitzray is a chazokah. One of the ways that you can acquire property, there are three ways, kesef, shtar, and chazokah. He didn't use kesef over here, he's using chazokah. And here's the chazokah. Once he does the chazokah, he can't back out of it. If he didn't do the chazokah yet, he can back out of it. That's the way Rashi explains it. Tosafot, for a number of reasons, does not like this explanation. Number one is, the Mishnah in Baba Batra tells us, what are the chazakot? Na'al, gadar, uparatz. Any one of those three things act as a chazakah to acquire property. If that's the case, why is the Gemara over here only giving this example of Daisha Mitzray? He walked the borders. What happens if na'al, gadar, uparatz? Why aren't they options here for him to do a kinyan chazakah? Number two question of the Tosafot is, why is the Gemara asking, Me'ema tavo chazakah? When does the chazakah go in place? What do you mean, when does the chazakah go in place? That question you can ask about any case when you're dealing with chazakah. Why in this particular case is the Gemara asking, when does the chazakah kick in? How come it doesn't ask it in any other case where you use a chazakah? Why doesn't it ask, when does the chazakah kick in? That's number two question on Rashi. And number three is, Daisha Mitzray, walking the borders, is not one of the three chazakot that's mentioned in Baba Batra. There it says, Na'al, Gadaru, Paratz. He has to take an action. Here it simply sounds like he's walking the borders of the property, and that's enough. So what type of chazakah is that? For those reasons, Tosafot says, V'nir lefarish, that the case here is, the Mayrik Shekano B'Kinyan Gamor B'Chalipino B'Shtar B'Chazakah, that here he bought it fully, with whatever proper kinyan that he needed to make, or Rafak Baporta, what Tosafot basically says is, there's no gemirat hadat in a transaction that is acquired through chalipin chazaka until you walk the borders. What does that mean, there's no gemirat hadat? It means that if orin claimants show up and question the validity of the sale, then it's not a final sale until you have that gemirat hadat, which is that you walk the property to see what the property is and what the needs of the property are. Vainu de Daisha Mitzray. That's what's going on in this case over here. Bono natan ma'ot ayri. It's a case where he didn't put up the money yet. Diva natan ma'ot ayri afil brachriot nami amai yecholak zorba mekshiv zikpa. Kilo olam yecholak zorba. But if he pays money, that is the ultimate gemira to that. Because even if he sells it with recourse, what does it mean? When you pay money, you can back out anytime you want? No. Once you paid money, that's final. Or that's the finality of the transaction. So what Tosafot in the end says is, we had a full-fledged kinyan over here, but we lacked gemira tadat. If you use money for the transaction, embedded in the money is gemira tadat because you let the money go. In the other cases, the other forms of kinyanim, whether it's chalipin or chazakah, in those cases, there's not complete gemira tadat because you didn't pay for it yet. So what the Gemara says is that we have this special gemira tadat threshold, and that's accomplished by Daish Amitzray. When you walk the borders of the field to see the needs of the field, That is a gemira tadat, as if you took it into your possession, even though you have yet to pay for it. So what the Gemara is speaking about here is not your regular chazakah. That was done already. That was acquired. The property was acquired. Talking about here is the gemira tadat, which says that this is the finality of the transaction. That finality only happens when he walks the borders of the property. And if he has yet to walk the borders of the property, he has in mind, or there's an embedded condition in the sale, that if there are questions that are raised about the property, that he can give it back. So that's the way Tosafot explains it. The Rambam, on the other hand, says that this is even in a case where he paid money. It's even in a case where he paid for the field and for the property. There's still no gemira tadat until you have Dayish HaMitzri, until you walk the borders of the property. So as opposed to Tosafot, who says that money would accomplish the same thing, or be gemira tadat, the Rambam says that even the payment of money is not gemira tadat until Dayish HaMitzri. So the Rambam, he's saying what you're saying. All the forms of kinyanim are the same. If you need gemira tadat, you're going to need it by kesef, shtar, or chazaka. So even if you did the kinyan through mamon, we're still, or kesef, we're still going to require daish mitzvah for there to be gemira tadat. We treat them all equally in that case. Tosafot says kesef is different than the other two, and you can understand that. Once you pay the money, you can't, that's done. You know, once the money leaves your hands, that's it. That's real gemira tadat. Whereas the Rashba says that the case here is where the transaction was done through money, and you don't have gemira tadat until daish mitzvah. That's an indication that even though there's evidence now that there might be problems with the ownership, if he walks the field, that's already an indication that he has accepted or is at peace with what's going on. It's almost the opposite of the Balei HaTosafot, which is that here you have a Kinyan Kesef, and then the Gemira Tadat is done through the Daish HaMitzrei. Again, the Rambam seems to equate all the different forms of Chazaka, say no matter which form of Chazaka you use, Daish HaMitzrei is the Gemira Tadat. The Tosafot Rabbeinu Peretz says it's actually a case where he paid money in a atra or location where money is not sufficient grounds to create a chazaka. We saw that in the Gemara previously, that there were different minhagim in different places as to what generated the finality of the acquisition, whether it was ma'ot or chazaka or both of them. What the Rabbeinu Peretz says is that this is a place where ma'ot are not sufficient, but the fact that you gave ma'ot downgrades the necessity for chazaka. Then you don't need Na'al Gadar Uparatz, the regular form of Chazakah. Daish HaMitzrei is sufficient Chazakah here to reinforce the Ma'ot and make it into a full-fledged Kinyan. Daish HaMitzrei, in the simplest form, means that he simply walks, as Tosafot says, the field to determine what is the needs or what are the necessities to deal with this field. For Rashi, there was the one to interpret Daish HaMitzrei means that he puts up a fence. He's putting up a fence around because that's the form of Kinyan according to Rashi. You can see in the Gota Gra that he brings from the Rif, and the Rambam says the same thing. The Daish HaMitzrei is that he actually knocks down the barriers that are between this field and his field to combine them into a single unit or to a single field. All right, we're going to stop here. 7 lines down on the top of Tet Amud Aleph.